experiencing different things along the way. I had the students read two different texts in preparation for this site visit. So one of the texts is called Notes for Noticing, and it's a piece that I wrote with my collaborator, Dana Bishop Root, as General Sisters. And we created this in 2021, and it was for a show at Tufts University. Notes for Noticing is an invitation for moving and observing in a place where you have been before, to connect with knowledge that is part of your histories, your feelings, and those that are with you. Place yourself in the place where you are, with all that you are, connecting with the knowledge that is part of your history in present tense. Collective knowledge, collecting knowledges. Who is with you? Where were you the last time you were moving through this path? Who named you? Who named this plant as a weed when we have known all along it is medicine? In this time, observation is your wealth. In this time, your senses connect the present to your histories of knowing. In this time, what do you want? In this time, find yourself in relation to. Noticing notes. The sound of your foot connecting with the ground. The scale of yourself in relation to what is rooted in the ground. What is left over from the season before? What is sprouting in the present tense? The seeds being released. Your knowing of this tree. Your knowing of its bark. Touch. And its knowing of you. Touch. Touching the length of a stem, tracing the outline of a leaf through all their seasons. Which death is a part, and therefore life? We have learned the trees are in communication with each other, with water, with soil, with microbes, from their root structures, their entanglements, and the space in between. With an inhale, your lungs welcome what you know.
Conversation.
Yes, yes. Right. Yeah, it's got many a generation of people. So.
Oh, so you like looked at the.
We
the
just
names.
Like walk around because they have like the Egyptian inspired graves and mausoleums. It's quite astonishing how it yeah. is. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The second text that I assigned to the students to read is Genealogy of Site Specificity by Miwon Kwan. It was published in 2002, and for me it's been an important text for thinking about a site-responsive or a site-reflexive art practice. She talks about the history of site specificity, and I'll just go ahead and read a little bit of the introduction because in the walk, the students refer to this text, and I think it's important to have a sense of what they're referring to. Site specificity used to imply something grounded, bound to the laws of physics. Often playing with gravity, site-specific works used to obstinate about presence, even if they were materially ephemeral, and adamant about immobility, even in the face of disappearance or destruction. Whether inside the white cube or out in the Nevada desert, whether architectural or landscape-oriented, site-specific art initially took the site as an actual location, a tangible reality in its identity, composed of a unique combination of physical elements. Length, depth, height, texture, and shape of walls and rooms, scale and proportion of plazas, buildings, or parks. Existing conditions of lighting, ventilation, traffic patterns, distinctive topographical features, and so forth. If modernist sculpture absorbed its pedestal base to sever its connection to or express its indifference to the site, rendering itself more autonomous and self-referential, thus transportable, placeless, and nomadic, then site-specific works, as they first emerged in the wake of minimalism in the late 60s and early 70s, forced a dramatic reversal of this modernist paradigm. Antithetical to the claim, if you have to change a sculpture for a site, there's something wrong with the sculpture, site-specific art, whether interruptive or simulative, gave itself up to its environmental context, being formally determined or directed by it. So that last part, giving itself, an artwork giving itself up to its environmental context, being formally determined or directed by it, is a huge part of what I think of as site responsive. And it's how I began my process and how I continue to think about how to create an artwork that is in relationship to a site, whether it's visible or invisible aspects of the site. So let's go on a walk.
I got really drawn to all the shale piles.
Yeah.
It's all over in this park, and it's actually one of the rocks that I used in my piece.
Oh.
Yeah. From nearby, but it was a huge effort to figure out how to bring it here. This is the first time I worked at this scale where it was things that I couldn't physically move. So involved hiring a truck with a, what is it called? An arm that lifts your thing.
Hydraulic lift?
A crane. I had to hire a crane operator to come and move the piece in, and then I had to hire somebody with a dump truck to come and pick up all the shale and then bring it here. And get all the permissions for all of that, too.
You hired me.
Well, at one point, I did think about just getting a basket, and with I got a backpack basket, and I was like, well, I could just move, 5 loads a day, and maybe I can do it by myself. And this could be part of the piece.
Yeah, it would be more durational.
Yes.
Oh, I like the root system on that tree. Sunset, golden hour. Yeah. Yes, photo language, photo lingo. Golden hour. If you're into portrait photography, right now would be a great time to take pictures. Very moody. Yeah.
I think it's amazing how where our image is reflected and where it's staring back at us.
Oh yeah.
It's so.
Oh, the shadow.
Vertical. It's like a movie.
Yeah, and it's almost to scale.
Yeah.
I spy with my little eye one thing in the world.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm thinking a lot about rocks and just paying attention to the sound of our feet on rocks. The earth is made of rocks. This is the thing that will forever be present. The stairs and everything, they were carved out of rocks. And I feel like I'm in a big rock right now.
So does that
with a little bit of other living things around, but it's a big rock. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so does that mean that all art is considered site specific? Right?
kind of.
Every
time I felt reading that.
Yeah.
I was like, well, if you expand this far, it's all site-specific work.
Yeah.
Same case,
everybody. Yeah.
Which takes away the whole point of using that as a definition.
Yeah, if everything is from rock and from, I guess, earth, in my mind.
But then the world is your site for making us. Like, everything is art.
Yeah, but they were saying in the article that if you think about discourse as a site, or if you think about history as a site, or if you think about, like, if you redefine what can be interpreted as site, then suddenly site-specific is anything that isn't, I don't know, like, full commodity.
Or a discrete object,
right?
In a space that the artist doesn't intend to have any relationship.
Well, even then,
I know,
as long as the space, as long as it has some sort of specificity to something, then according to that article, it would be site specific.
Drain water.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So that's a uncovered, like,
part of our drainage system. So throughout the park, you'll see, like, probably what you'll see up there at the top of the road. I know exactly where it is. There is a grating, and the stream runs under the road, and then it comes down here, and it probably goes under here. It comes down, probably drains somewhere over there.
So it's like a culvert, but small.
Exactly.
Yep.
Why?
Because it's clay. It's cracked probably because it's clay, and it something hit it and it broke it.
Oh, it's terracotta.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that's what the little pottery pieces we saw are.
Oh. Maybe.
You saw pottery pieces on this walk already?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you gotta pay attention. So is walking a significant part of your practice?
It became part of it since I started. I mean, it's part of how it's one pace and one mode for me, like, moving through the world. And it became more significant in my practice when I started making these public artworks. And because I was placing them in locations that maybe felt more like a destination for some people. And so the question of how do people arrive to it? How do people find it? And then, do I organize walks as part of it? And then I started thinking about how to think about disability and walking. And I started to consider other words for walk, even that was more inclusive of different kinds of movement. And so the word that I arrived at was amble.
Amble.
A-M-B-L-E.
Kind of like a slow walk or a meander.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And more about the journey.
Yes, yeah. So here we're at a crossroads and we're going to go down. I didn't know this was called the Ponticulus Trail, but we're going to go down to the Ponticulus Trail. And then we're going to go down to the Lake Trail. So we're going further down into Panther Hollow. And it's named that because there were actual panthers here. At one point.
Oh.
Back to that.
Ambling is, like, really deeply tied to spirituality.
Oh.
I'm taking the Asian architecture class right now, and a lot of the Buddhist temples are designed so you can sort of circumambulate within them.
Oh, totally.
So basically means you just walk around in circles and meditate.
Yeah, walking meditation.
Can I ask you whether you have your own definition of site-specific that you think encompasses either more or less than another?
Yes. Yes. Maybe we'll...
Water sounds.
Yeah, there's some water sounds. I will definitely answer that question and add to it. about my own definition of site specificity. And I guess what I want to throw back to you all is that, so Kwan, in her essay, outlines, in the essay, Genealogy of Site Specificity, outlines these three different paradigms, right? The phenomenological, the discursive, and the institutional. So I think maybe, you know, and she goes into it and says that, like, a lot of works mix up all those things, right? So I'd be curious, after you all see the piece, which aspects, which paradigms you see present or at play in the piece.
Before you answer our question.
What you're doing.
Okay. But what I will say is that I do like the word site specificity, site specific, and I do use it to talk about my practice. I also like to use the word site reflexive, and reflexive as in, like, turning back on itself to think about the site as also activated, and how through the artwork I can ask questions of the site, and the site can ask questions of itself.
Interesting. That feels to me more like the original intended site-specific definition.
Yes.
That they were speaking of in the beginning of the piece.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, an important aspect of site specificity to return to, at least somewhat, once you've expanded, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there is something very special about the idea of the environment and the artwork in conversation.
Yes.
Very specifically.
Yes.
And not just the artwork in conversation with something.
Mm-hmm.
In any environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was that. That felt like it was being lost to me in the article.
Okay.
As it was expanded, even though in my own practice, I was like, oh yeah, now, like, yeah, I do have discourse, site discourse, and
Yeah. So you were identifying with it.
It opened up some talk for you.
Hey Annie, do you see that? That dead tree with all the rocks underneath it that are, like, holding it up.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Especially because the rocks have almost this, like, platform-like quality to them.
Does something smell good, Alina?
No, it's just nature, and I'm part of the nature. I'm just...
So beautiful.
Very beautiful.
Nature, nature, take me as your bride. Virginia Woolf's Orlando.
I don't even have a response to that.
To try to prevent it from going to, like, bring down the hill.
The dirt around the rocks.
Mm-hmm. I lived on a creek as a kid. their house backed right up to it. And they were like, one day this creek will be all the way to your back porch. But it was like 35 feet away from the house. It was crazy.
We also had a creek in our old house that when there was a big storm and flash floods, all of the runoff from the like suburban sprawl roads would funnel down into our creek. And because our house didn't back up onto the creek, but it was the same level as the creek in the basement. And then it was built into a hill. And we would get 3 feet of water in our basement.
Wow.
Bad. Really bad. And we sold it just in time.
Yeah.
To not have to put that on the Zillow listing. But that's real. These stone walls that we're walking on right now prevent the creek from changing position over time.
Yeah.
So you can do that if you have a creek in your backyard. Wood makes a really nice instrument.
Thank you.
Wyatt's first reaction was, this is cool.
Thanks for sharing that. So the two kinds of rock that I chose to use here are both from this area. It's called the Allegheny Plateau. And so there's the slabs, which are almost like 5 feet long, and they're made out of sandstone. And then underneath them, and like where we're standing, that's the shale. You can see it up here too. And it's also covering a lot of the part that I dug up that has all the pipes, that has holes in it, that's collecting all the water. So yeah, this piece is called Drip Seep Run, and I applied to the city of Pittsburgh, had this call for artists, and I applied. I said I was interested, and they didn't require a proposal, which was great because that part takes so much time. And as I started to spend time in the park and learn about the park, I had already been working with human connections to water through this other project, and I was curious about springs. And so I was learning about where springs are in the park, and it was winter time. And I was working with a geologist, and I asked him, how do I know where the springs are? And he was like, you just, wherever it's like, there's ice on the ground, like a frozen patch of ice. And so I started just walking through the park and figuring out where the springs were. To me, it was like this hidden well right? There's this water. And there already is this history of having springs in the park that were fountains where people would go with jugs of water and fill up their cups and jugs. And so I was interested in bringing that back into the park in a way. So I found a few different possible locations. And the first location that I was interested in was right off the road. And that's the one that I really wanted. I wanted it to be really accessible where someone could just drive up and get out of their car and go see the piece. But it turns out that that site was the start and finish line of a car race that happens every year. And the city was very worried that the artwork would get damaged. So this was the second best site. And it is a short walk. I guess it probably took us like 20 minutes maybe to get here. There's another entrance from this playground and it's shorter. It's more like 10 minutes. But yeah, it was challenging to decide to put my piece in the middle of the woods. I love the woods. I like spend like lots of my spare time in the woods, but it was definitely a choice. It felt like I was hiding something and making a destination. And then over the years, the past couple of years after the piece being installed, I keep on meeting people who live in Pittsburgh who are like, I run in the park and I see your piece, or I take my dog out. And so it's like, it really, the more I spend time out here, I realize that lots of people use this trail and use this park and they feel a sense of ownership to the park. So thinking about like the public of the park, it was much bigger than I imagined. And it was much more of like people felt a sense of ownership about the park, which was really, really cool. So,
is the water drinkable?
The water, it would need to be filtered. So that's one thing I was also working with the geologist on. And he told me that we looked at studies. So he had a grad student who was studying all the springs and she tested all the water. And the major contaminants were, can anyone guess?
Dog,
actually.
Oh. And what did you think?
It's actually, it might be lead, but it's basically like from cars, because the road is right above us. Mm-hmm. It's from the brakes. Like people putting on their brakes and it wears down the metal. And so then the metal runs through the soil, through water, washing off. And so that's in the water. So the water picks up whatever is around.
Is the reason that it's not clean because it's so close? Is it a factor of distance or depth of the spring? Or because I know there are other springs. Mm-hmm. Certainly springs up in Maine that we've drank from that are like the local place to get water.
Yeah.
And tons of people stop and get water there all the time, which is historically,
it's like the best water.
It's so water good. Fountain. Yeah. It feels like a water fountain.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if it's just the urban environment or if it's, you know, or if there's some measurable percolation factor that it has to go through.
I'm not certain, but I would guess it's the proximity to the road and probably the depth of the spring. Yeah.
Would you encourage people to, like, say, because they have, like, tools where you could, like, filter your own water? So, like, somebody came along and then, like...
Yeah. I would, yeah.
If I had my backpack on, if I had brought it, I have a Life straw in there and we could have sampled. Sorry.
You carry that with you? The Life straw.
Yes, I do. I also gave my stepsons ones for their cars.
Wow.
We could have tasted the water.
Yeah.
That would have been cool.
Next time.
So I did. So what's inscribed into the stone says this water isn't safe to drink. Or this water comes from an underground spring. It isn't safe to drink. Use with care. Because I felt like a certain sense of responsibility that by putting this here, it would indicate that it was safe to drink. So I felt the need to add that text. But I'm sure lots of dogs come here and drink this water every day. It's like their spot.
For better or for worse.
I mean, I love the idea that I made a dog drinking fountain, but, you know, I was very inspired by these like public watering holes, like these springs in towns where you could go and it's like plumbed properly and it's like always flowing with water. I love that. And like the non-privatization of water. But I was also looking at these Japanese stone, like these like kind of ritual places for cleansing that are like outside, like in gardens or outside of temples and shrines. So it's like you would approach and then you would either drink some water or you would wash your hands or wash your face before you go in. And yeah, so to me, it's also like that. It's like this space of like contemplation that honors the water.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm taking a malt making class, and Britt today was talking about how one thing you should consider when making sculpture or works is like whether you want the materials to, like, are the material, do the materials degrade? Are they meant to last forever? Mm-hmm. So when you're creating like your site specific work, are you thinking about, yeah, the materiality and the time in relation to that? And like, cause you know, this is something mm-hmm. that I think will live on for like, you know, past year, I mean, years.
Yeah.
So is that something that you deeply consider?
That came up, when I knew I was designing something that was deemed permanent. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that when Alina brought up the point about, how everything is rock, right? Everything is rock, like all over the planet. And when I thought about the idea of a permanent artwork and materiality, I went to rock first. Mm-hmm. And of course, rock changes over time. And we looked at the shale that breaks really easily. That's one kind of rock, but like symbolically, rocks represent this kind of permanence, right? Mm-hmm. This, stability. And so it was interesting to start with that and then to work with a structural engineer and plan how to move water over a rock. And my goal is that the water will eventually change the shape of the rocks. Mm-hmm. It will probably also, like, water freezing and moving the soil will eventually move them, you know. They are attached to concrete bases, so it will take a lot to move them. It will probably be after my life is over on this planet. Yeah, but
that's pretty short in terms of rock. Like sandstone and shale are like actually really soft.
Yes, for rock. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And that's interesting to me. Yeah. Is like to use this rock that is a soft rock.
They used to use it for tombstones and
they don't anymore.
They don't because all the words disappear.
Yes.
So
yes.
They replaced it mostly with granite now.
Yes. Yeah.
I really appreciate it because I have an appreciation for it and like this idea of like creating works in unity with where we're at, like, you know, environmentally. And maybe that's something that I think down the line as I continue to work through my own, like, figuring out what is interdisciplinary for me and, like, thinking about how a work environment, you know, interacts with an environment, you know, versus just, like, thinking about presentation in a specific space and then taking it away. Like, what does it mean to, like, not even have that institution of a space, like, going out in the world and creating with that in mind
or with the opposite or with like impermanence in mind too. I think that those things in conversation are really cool
because I think this is a different level of like thinking in an archival way. Coming from like a photo background, we're always told like it's a paper archive, like what are you using, like an acid backing wood, and like thinking about that. But this is like an extension of thinking about the archival usage of materials.
I will also add too, so at the end of the three stone pieces, the water runs across the trail and it's a wooden runnel, and that wood is this wood that's called black locust, and that's used to make fence posts that last for hundreds, like 100 plus years. So that also has a long lifespan. Yeah.
I like that. For land art, it doesn't do very much intervening. It's sort of more about highlighting the thing mm-hmm. that's already here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, walking up to it for, because the color really like blends into the soil and the leaves, and it has sort of an infrastructural like palette mm-hmm. and it's pretty modest as well.
Mm-hmm.
You might mistake it for a piece of infrastructure
mm-hmm.
until mm-hmm. you walk up and you see like the letters in a spiral and
mm-hmm.
and that it's like behaving like a fountain.
mm-hmm.
It's also very specifically speaking to that like first opening paragraph of the article that talks about gravity as being very site, like the site specific thing that yes. we do, which I kind of love that though. And I think that there's some of the things that work most effectively for the most people in site specific work are things that are common and related, like mm-hmm. to your point about infrastructure, right? Like mm-hmm. having it in conversation with that is actually really relatable, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. having it not disrupt gravity is actually mm-hmm. really relatable. You know, it's they're like you said, rules. Highlighting.
Yeah. They're the rules that we live by, yeah, that exactly. our world lives by. Yeah,
exactly. I think, too, it's interesting because I think something that's coming back up, or not coming back up, but like a conversation that I feel like is approaching all different types of art is how you consider climate change mm. in your art making. Which you don't have to, obviously, mm-hmm. right?
But as
part of the discourse.
Yeah, it's part of the discourse. But as you know, that becomes a real reality, I think, thinking about installation and land art, like Annie referenced, is something to consider as like a part of an art. Like, obviously, like, you don't have to make that a part of your art practice. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very real reality. And mm-hmm. so,
yeah.
It's like, should we start considering that?
And actually, I think for landscape architects, there's a lot of like flood plain yes. site specific architecture that they put in to manage mm-hmm. flood water in a very similar way to mm-hmm. what this is doing.
Mm-hmm. Like a retention wall or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
But the better ones are doing it artistically and not just utility.
I also think Pittsburgh is a unique place to consider that as well, too, given the history of materiality and, like, steel mills and things like that, but then also what this region of the country is situated in that conversation of, like, climate change and, like, the changing landscapes and mm-hmm. things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how, over time, how a lot of these ideas and discourse evolve. You know, maybe mm-hmm. every land artists will come to Pittsburgh because it's like the safe area.
Yeah.
What's the maintenance like on this piece?
You know, I think that it literally, this is the most maintenance that it's had mm-hmm. since it's since it was installed. Besides right. like all the installation and like, you know, zhuzhing that happened. Well, one thing that happened is that there was a lot of digging that happened to make the piece, and probably more, definitely more than what needed to happen. So that part of the trail got really damaged because the digging like basically unleashed these springs that were there. And I tried to compact it back down, but I couldn't do it by hand. So that is one piece, like repairing that part of the trail is like something that has been on my mind since the install. The city said they would do some, like, move some giant rocks over there, but it's like these different entities, like the park is different from the city, and like the park rangers are different from the city public art people. So getting them to agree on what the maintenance is and who's going to do it and who's going to pay for it has been kind of an uphill battle.
Yeah.
And then it's also like, I worked with this engineer to design how the whole thing worked, and he works on like stormwater systems, and he was like, you need to have this this compost sock, and you can see it kind of with the wooden stakes around the edge to protect all of the dirt that's flowing into the stream, because the EPA protects, there's all these regulations to protect waterways. And the installer that I hired was like trying to cut corners, and she was like, we don't need that. And the engineer came to look at the piece after the first day of installation. He's like, where's the compost sock? And I was like, I know. And so I had to like go and get it and bring it myself and, you know, things like that where it's just like everyone is, has their own ideas of how to do the job.
Mm-hmm. How like the installation sort of began to be a performance piece about illustrating the bureaucracy that is damaging our environment.
Also site specific.
I feel like I come probably like once a season. Yeah. And I would see that, I would say the maintenance is mostly like me coming and like cleaning out the leaves, but they are going next level right now. Which is amazing.
I have to get a little of that sound.
I know it changes like based on
seasonally, season, yeah,
but also like is that part of like what happened with that section, or that was like from the digging, like, or it started to like put more water into one section, or
well, I didn't know it. So before the digging happened, all that was here was a big wet spot, so it was really I couldn't really see like what was the amount of the flow until we put it all together. Mm-hmm. So,
That's interesting.
So I don't know what it was, what it was like.
It sort of like becomes like infrastructure for pedestrians and runners because you're redirecting the water away from the path.
Yes. I think in some ways it did. It was already a very muddy trail because of where it's located. Like this is kind of one of the lowest points, but I think that it got more, I don't know. It's hard to know like what part is my own anxiety of making the piece and like feeling like I messed something up. I changed the landscape. But yeah.
You know, I mean, like, there's a, it's not, I don't know, it's just like, I empathize with that, but I think you have not caused damage to this site. I guess I'm not a scientist, so.
Rebecca just talked to me.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm thinking a little bit about Alina and Bulumko's conversation that led to that conversation about those quote-unquote site-specific works at the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you think, how you're thinking through site-specific, you know, relating this and that and your own thoughts.
I don't know if I'm responding to that directly or just site-specificity in general with the last bit of conversation that any engineer were having, but like changing the environment and stuff. Like we were walking by and there was a lot of tarp, so like all of it is changed and managed, but then there's an illusion that parks are not, right? And then deserts are not mingled with, but every place is mingled with, and pieces like this or like the pyramids, they just make it obvious that we are everywhere, like our species is everywhere.
Yeah, there is no pristine. There's no, we can't get back.
This is landscaped. It's a combination of human and nature, but it's, we walked over all those bridges, right? Like there are paths everywhere. This is definitely had human hands in its design. So,
but that's true of so much of the U.S. in general. I mean, whole forests that were farmland that are now forests again, where the trees are only 100 years old.
I guess like the sort of thing that we pay attention to is like, how can we maintain it for who's here now and be as like non-destructive as possible?
Yeah.
yeah. moving forward.
But yeah, exactly.
Do no harm.
I feel like we should head back because it's getting dark. Yeah. How do you all feel?
Yeah, we didn't bring our headlamps.
I know.
We have flashlights on
and our lights draw.
And our lights draw.
Okay, so we can walk back when we can, or we can go a little bit further down and loop up and walk on that upper trail. Does anyone have a preference? Go back this way?
Which one is the safest? I just asked.
Because it's going to... Okay, then let's do that.
I think we go that way because it's getting darker.
Yeah.
Have you ever camped before, Alina?
I've not.
It's kind of fun.
What is up?
It's my grandma's camping.
Well, I mean, I'm going to that just by the word I'm so...
It's like, but then you have a cabin. You go back.
Or we can go up to Morgan's summer house.
Oh,
no.
does sound cancerous.
Sounds very cancerous.
Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Ebony Spectrum and In Black America.
So last week, I don't know when y'all gonna watch this, Tiff is mad at me. Just recently.
Yes. You said it right last week.
Okay, I can say that. But it really was last week. So Tiff is gonna be like, say last month.
No, last week.
Recently, Al Sharpton met with the Target CEO. He put up a post with him in the picture with the Target CEO, Franklin Richardson, who's his board chair, and one of his advisors. And people were relentless. They went off on him. How dare you do this? Blah, 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 blah. Jamal Bryant later shared that he was in that meeting, actually. But people, including me, were upset that Jamal wasn't there, but Jamal was there. And so I'm bringing this up as an example of something. Reverend Al's tactics are different. His tactics are, when I'm doing something, I'm going to tell you all because I want, in his mind, I want to be accountable to the people so that you know what I've done. That is a tactic. There are civil rights leaders, including Reverend Jackson, who embrace that tactic. There are others who think that if you advertise what you've done, it's an endorsement, or it says that now, don't worry, y'all, I got it, we're good. Yeah. And that's an approach, right? And there's broad disagreement on which way is right or wrong. Either one could be right or wrong.
I was going to ask, do you have an opinion on which one is right or wrong?
I think the thing that I would, and I feel bad because I have not talked to him about this, I would invite him into considering everything not needing to be in the press, especially when the deal is not struck. I don't know that my approach is right. I think that there are people who see that and they get energized by him posting, like, oh, look, we won a battle, so now maybe we can win the war.
Yeah.
Like, I get that. But I also think that our tactics have to be more sophisticated. Like, there are young business leaders that I would invite into those conversations because they talk to those leaders at those corporations in ways that I don't.
Right.
I think that maybe there shouldn't be one at the table, or just two, because there were four, but like have different types of people at the table for those 100%. Meetings. Anyway.
Well, I had a challenge, I'll say.
Yeah.
Because it looked like a win for Target. Like, you got this picture, you got to go promote it. I will say this about Rev. He invited me to join him on his radio show weekly, where we would talk politics and help me build a following. During my time at MSNBC, I think he tried to be helpful while I was there, and extended himself to me. So I appreciate that from Reverend Sharpton. I just want to be very transparent about that. I also want to be very transparent about the fact that there is this perception that Reverend Sharpton is a leader in Black America. He is a leader, yes. There's a very tiny sect of Black America who follows the steps of Reverend Sharpton. I do not believe, or I don't, I won't say I believe, I know that he does not lead the masses as he once did.
Well, does, though?
That's my point.
Okay.
We are a leaderless movement, to your point. We're a leaderless movement at this point. There is no, you know, back in the day, pre-Twitter and, you know, Instagram, we had five to 10 leaders. And even all the leaders didn't get shine. You know, Dr. Dorothy Height was a member at that table. She did not